You're listening to Girovagando by the Cycling Podcast. Today we are in Lucca.
Cozze, citele, cozze, cozze, vicine, nu spigudeci cora, nu spigudeci cora. Cozze, citele, cozze, cozze, vicine, nu spigudeci cora, se nu mangiano le femmine.
Buonasera, Brian Cin Cin again.
Salute,
Cin Cin. Daniel. Brian, last night, what was the question I asked? In what other languages, in what other countries of the world, or I wondered aloud whether in other countries of the world besides Italy, people said Cin Cin. I was inundated. Seems like in every country people say Cin Cin. Even in the UK, the country in which I grew up, and this had either, well, it escaped my notice or I had forgotten it. Brian, describe the scene. Describe what we're drinking first, because that's how we started this evening, with that nice clinking of glasses.
You know, I rode past on my bike when these vines were just planted. This is a wine from Pieve Santo Stefano, which is just above a house I lived in for 5 years.
Rather palatial house, I seem to recall.
And the vineyards are on the other side of a hill that the riders passed today with 8 kilometers to go. And it's really, I know the people who make the wine, I never had this white wine because in the years I've been away, it wasn't, the vines weren't producing fruit.
Grape variety?
I haven't even smelled it. My guess would be Chardonnay.
Okay. It doesn't taste like Chardonnay.
Then it's probably Vermentino.
Yeah, it tastes quite sort of zesty, almost Riesling like.
Vermentino then.
Brian, this is a scene. The scene you're about to describe is a scene that should be, I'm supposing, very familiar to you because you know this city very well. We are in Lucca. And where precisely are we in Lucca?
So,
describe the scene, please.
Yeah, I mean, we're sitting with the smell of jasmine flowers, which is one of my favorite things about this time of year.
Smells don't translate very well in podcasting.
No, but anyways, we can see the white flowers from here where we're sitting. We're sitting at the end of Via Filongo, which is the main street of Lucca inside the walls. And we're just adjacent to Piazza Santa Maria. And walking here before starting to record, I just dropped in at the Ciclipoli to say hello, which is a very famous old bike shop here in Lucca, and a place that has a lot of history that's connected to Danish professional riders. And when I first moved here, I lived in a small apartment on Piazza San Francesco, which is 500 meters from where we're sitting. Didn't speak a word of Italian. Lived above a news paper store. And that was really where my Italian adventure started. I haven't really been away other than my years in California.
Your adventure started here, and an adventure began for a lot of Danes who are linked with cycling, as we will find out and as we will discuss a bit later. We're in Lucca, the city often associated with Puccini, who was born here, often also associated with Verdi, another composer who was born just up the road in Busseto in 1813. Verdi, I'm going to concentrate on tonight, Brian, because there's a link with someone we're going to hear from later in the episode. Giuseppe Verdi, son of an innkeeper and a spinner, whatever a spinner is, not spinster, a spinner, composer of Otello, La Traviata, Il Trovatore, etc. We saw a pretty operatic, dramatic, spectacular stay today in this Giro d'Italia, which continues to delight and excite, as I predicted it would, because I said this was a great route and Mauro Vegni had done a fantastic job. So I predicted all of this, but it is turning into a humdinger. Maybe we'll talk about that in just a little while.
I'll be the first to establish corrections corner in a grandiose way.
The biggest corrections corner we've ever heard on the Cycling Podcast. Brian, it is that time of the evening where tradition dictates we summarize the stage, tell people what happened. It is time for Il Processo alla Tappa.
Il Processo alla Tappa, the post-stage inquisition.
Well, Brian, usually around this time I ask not where we are now and not where the stage finished, because we've already covered that, but where do we start this morning and how long was today's stage?
If you include our desperate
chasing.
Don't
mention the incident.
Yeah, we were just trying to struggle getting to the start today. It was very stressful. There was a lot of traffic, and it started in Genova, in Liguria, and then it followed the coast, apart from a detour of today's climb, all the way down through Versilia, through my hometown of Pietrasanta, and then into Lucca via the Valfredana.
How many kilometers was today's stage, Brian?
178 kilometers was stage five of this Giro.
Were there any breaks on today's stage?
There certainly was, but unlike what often happens when there's a breakaway stage, it's, you know, often the early breakaway that then gets caught and the real action sort of starts. But this today was different because there was an early breakaway and they actually got caught on the descent of today's big climb. I should mention them. It was Mattia Baez, Luis Eske, Simon Geschke and Manuele Tarozzi. They did manage to get, like I said, across the one big climb of today, the Passo del Bracco, with Simon Geschke being the first rider across. But on the descent and later on into the stage, it was actually an attack by four riders that eventually dominated basically everything that happened after that. It was Benjamin Thomas of Cofidis, Michael Velgren of EF Education, Andrea Pietrobon, and Enzo Paleni.
This was, Brian, or it should be a question because this is the Processo alla Tappa. Was this after the intermediate sprint?
Yeah, Daniel, the real breakaway of the day, the one that actually defined the outcome of the stage, happened after the intermediate sprint.
Who was in that break, Brian?
So in that break was Benjamin Thomas, Michael Velgren, Andrea Pietrobon, and Enzo Paleni of Groupama Française de Jeux.
This is a hard question. I'm putting you on the spot here. Do you know roughly what their maximum advantage was? I know roughly where their advantage stayed for a long time. It was just over a minute for a long time. Should we just go with that for now?
I think it was. I think they were up to a minute and 40, but I'm not sure. I mean, the interesting thing was that it was always going to be down to very few seconds because there was only this one Category 4 climb in the final, and after that it was basically a descent all the way into Lucca.
Any crashes in the last 50 kilometers?
Yeah.
Anyone significant come down?
Unfortunately, yes. There was a crash actually in the town of Pietrasanta. It looked as if the one worst off was Riley Pickrell from Israel Premier Tech, but my understanding is that he actually hit his nose, and as we all know, it can cause a lot of bleeding. He was certainly bleeding quite a bit. And then there was, just before the climb of Montemagno, the last Category 4 climb, there was a crash as well. To my knowledge, no one has exited the race because of these crashes.
I don't believe so. Seven riders came down: Valter, Muluburan, Milesi, Woods, Reisberg, and Foss. I spoke to one of those riders after finish, Attila Valter. More about him later on, but he suggested to me that he was okay. Brian, Trek were pulling. They were probably the team that was devoting most resources to the chase, but Jayco Alula were also pulling. They were getting help from other teams as well, the odd rider here or there. They were riding very fast. They were, well, we saw at one stage how fast the brake was going, how fast the peloton was going, both over 60 kilometers an hour on the run into Lucca off the Monte Magno. Then, as they came into the last sort of 3 kilometers, the gap was still around 30 seconds. Then what happened in the last 2 or 3 kilometers, Brian?
I mean, it was a real thriller. You know, in the if you go in this direction into Lucca, you you pass quite a narrow, like a little shopping street. I mean, it's just on the other side of the wall from where we're sitting, and it's cobbled. And it was sort of, I think it was roundabout then that, at least hearing from one of the riders, they kind of had an idea that this could be it, you know, and that normal calculation of, you know, 10 seconds per kilometer was more or less on and off the mark. And then there was I wouldn't say a surprise attack, but, you know, Andrea Pietrobon hadn't been the most active in the breakaway, but he, just as Michael Velgren was turning around to see where the others were, he attacked on the other side. And then it was a kind of a pokerish game, cat and mouse-ish kind of a situation before the final run-in. And I think Michael Wengren burned a few matches there, but what a brilliant final it was by Thomas Benjamin Thomas. So smart. I think he used his medicine experiences. I know I'm not allowed to say track rider, but the nous that sort of gave him in the final parts of the stage were brilliant. It won him the stage with Michael Wengren on second spot.
What was their advantage? So four breakaway riders stayed away, effectively. What was their advantage to the on-rushing bunch?
11 seconds, Daniel.
11 seconds. Yeah. And who headed that bunch? Who came in behind them, effectively?
Jonathan Milan did. I mean, there was obviously, for that reason, that little trek was, they were chasing. And they actually got help from Jake Walula as well in the latter part of the stage. And they were, Caleb Ewan finished sixth, so, and Philip Bauhaus was seventh, Tim Olivier eighth, Olaf Coyne ninth, and Mattis Mikkels. We see him more and more around the pointy ends of the stages. He was in 10th.
Brian, I'm going to wrap up the Processo alla Tappa pretty swiftly tonight because I'm just looking through the various competitions and there were no significant changes anywhere, really. General classification, no changes at all in the top 21 positions. Tadej Pogacar still leads by 46 seconds. And in third place is Dani Martinez, fourth Utebrooks, fifth Rubio. Points competition is still led by Milan. King of the Mountain still led by Pogacar. Kalmajan didn't manage to get any points today. And in the youth classification, Utebrooks still leads from Baudin of Decathlon AG2R, La Mondiale team. Brian, usually at this point in the Processo alla Tappa, you ask me a question.
Yeah, and I'd actually like to add to that because you were away for quite a while after the stage. So I was wondering, like, what happened, Daniel? Who did you talk to? Did someone give you very long answers?
I talked, Brian, to two of your countrymen. I usually speak to one of your countrymen at the finish. Today it was a couple, Michael Valgren, a very emotional Michael Valgren for understandable reasons. He has an association, as I think we already hinted, with Luca, another former rider who used to live in Lucca, Matty Breschel, who is now his director sportif at EF Education First Easy Post, and also one of the riders who was heavily involved in the chase behind that leading quartet, friend of the podcast, Jaco Alula's Alessandro De Marchi.
Yeah, you know, it was a hard stage when Alpecin tried to put the sprinters under pressure, and then it became easy, and then actually Benjamin came to me and said, "Hey, Michael, we are 6-7 guys who wants to attack after the sprint," and I said, "You ready?" So actually I said no, because I crashed yesterday, I had pain in my knee, but I said, you know, why not try, you know. We were only four, actually three and a half maybe only, but we worked really well together, really strong guys. So yeah, it was nice to go to the line, and in the end Benjamin is a really good rider, so yeah, it's a shame, but I'm happy to be in the mix again.
At what moment do you understand you could go for the win, really?
Well, it was actually only with, I'd say, 3-4K to go. Because you always think the peloton will take 10 seconds per kilometer, more or less, you know. But, like, yeah, we kept working well together, and it was in our favor. It was kind of downhill. You can only go a certain speed, right, with the same gearing. So yeah, again, chapeau to the other guys for working well together, and we didn't started to play the games, you know, so yeah, it was nice. Yeah, the Pulte guy was taking short turns, not super strong, and then he came with a late attack, which kind of, you know, I think it messed up the cooperation, obviously, and I had to go a really long sprint, and hopefully I could do a Magnus Cort Nielsen sprint, you know, but yeah, I have to learn a bit more, but yeah, we worked good together, and we knew it was going to be difficult, right? So, but yeah, we made it.
Michael, first and foremost, I know it's not a win, but where you come from, what does this mean to you?
It's a Giro, right? Like, it means a lot. A few years back, I was not sure if I had a contract, right? So the team really helped me through this in a really good way. And I'm happy to start to pay things back, you know, and I'm just grateful I can still be a cyclist. So yeah, thanks for everybody. Yeah.
Michael, in Lucca too, which is a special place for you, right?
Yeah, you know, it was my home once for 1 year, my first year as a pro with Daxo. So it has some special meaning for sure. Like, I knew the last 50K, right? So it was nice to be back.
Did that local knowledge, was that a big advantage, Michael, particularly knowing the Monte Magno climb?
I think knowing the Monte Magno climb was a good one to know, right? But the rest was just pretty straightforward, to be honest. And you know, nowadays you have the map on the computer, and we know everything with VeloViewer and everything, so it doesn't really come as a shock for anybody. But you know, like, when you're kind of on your home roads, you always get 10% extra in the legs, right? And that's also the feeling I had today. Like, I felt good, so yeah.
It wasn't a plan to hit the morning break, but with the situation we were in, like no breakaway sprinter teams are going flat out for these points. We saw this small opportunity that, you know, if we could get up the road in a strong group, it would maybe be possible. So my calculation, a bit similar to the stage where Magnus won last year, was 1 minute on the top of Monte Magno. 20k slightly down with the wind from the back, it's super difficult to chase. And then luckily we had Benjamin Thomas there, who unfortunately ended up being the fastest guy. But I mean, it gives us confidence that it is possible to flick the sprinter teams.
Especially, I guess, when a break, when you can't get away in the middle of a stage, then I guess everyone is that much fresher as well. Is that the case?
Yeah, exactly. And it's a less effort than being in the break for 5 hours, considering that there's more chances and more opportunities to come, and the Giro is long. So yeah, it was two hours flat out, 2.5. And then, as you say, you know, we're here in Lucca. Michael used to live here.
First year as a pro, is that right?
Yeah, and I mean, I lived here for 13 years. So it meant a great deal to me also if we would have won the stage. But yeah, now obviously we're disappointed, but we also, yeah. For me, I get quite emotional when I think about Michael and what he went through. To be injured is a full-time job, but he really put the work in it, and came back and stayed confident and never ever gave up, really. So one thing is coming back riding your bike, another thing is to come back on a very high level. That takes a lot of hard work, blood and sweat and tears, you know.
Okay, well, Alessandro, we saw you pulling there. You were one of many riders trying to pull that group back. Just give us a sense of, well, how fast it was, how many watts you were all doing, and, well, how fast they were going at the front.
How many watts? I don't know. Well, it was a lot because, I mean, the speed was super high, so in the end, you don't go too much faster than in the front. So I think the mistake was made immediately when I got 1:20. That was already done, I think, the thing. And so that's it. That is probably the best situation. You just have a 70-80k to race, and it was coming after an hard part of the stage, so everybody was tired, of course, especially the team of the sprinters. So it was the perfect timing. They were perfect.
And in cycling in the last 2 or 3 years, well, it's getting harder and harder sometimes to bring these breaks back, isn't it, with everyone in skin suits, everyone with these super aero bikes.
Everybody's able to do big speed now. Everybody is able to maintain the speed for long periods, long times, a lot of kilometers. So the thing is to gain that gap that you can keep until the end, and then four guys, I mean, they can be fast.
The cycling podcast at the 2024 Giro d'Italia is supported by MAP cycling apparel.
Well, Brian, an emotional day for a few riders. I'm guessing an emotional day for Benjamin Thomas. You were in his press conference. He's a rider who a lot of listeners will know has settled in Italy. A Frenchman settling in Italy. I mean, the French and the Italians are like oil and water. Someone will dispute this. Listen, I think I've said this on the podcast before, and it's been disputed by either an Italian or a Frenchman. But when you live in Italy, and when you know a lot of Italians, you hear a lot of kind of anti sort of French, and a lot of it is kind of light-hearted and funny on occasions, but they do sort of lock horns, the French and the Italians, don't they?
Oh, absolutely.
Particularly about food.
Anyone who would deny that, I've definitely had another experience here. I mean, I think it's maybe easy actually for me to see as an outsider. I live here, I obviously work and have worked a lot in France, so I get it. But I think my theory is the French has it with every other nation. And I think Italy has it a little bit more.
Let's not make any more enemies. Let's not make any more enemies.
I'm not an anthropologist here, obviously.
Brian, Benjamin Thomas, he has settled in Italy. He's become an Italophile, an adopted Italian. He lives up near Lake Garda. Did he say exactly where he lives? Is it?
It's close to Desenzano.
Very close to Desenzano. We're going to have the second time trial of this Giro d'Italia. Brian, he's got something in common with me. Do you know what it is? He's a keen cook, and one of his specialities is risotto. So I don't know whether he's used that to woo his now Italian partner.
I've known you for 20 years. I had no idea you were a keen cook.
Okay, well, there's a lot that you don't know about me, Brian. But Benjamin,
the year is still long.
But Benjamin Thomas rides for Cofidis. Cofidis is a team that's, well, I mean, it's often mocked for its lack of success over a long period of time, and they've had these long droughts in major tours. Last year, of course, they had a fantastic Tour de France. They won two stages. They've had a poor start to the season. There have been reports recently about a big audit having been carried out at Cofidis because the management, or well, the sponsors as well, are slightly miffed that some of the other French teams, for example, Decathlon AG2R La Mondiale, have been thriving recently, and the Cofidis bosses, the people who are putting in the money, they want to know why it is that Cofidis haven't been able to compete. And well, they saw some fruits today of whatever that audit revealed. Thomas is a talented rider, though. He's very versatile. He can sprint. Of course, he's had a lot of success on the track. He's a very good descender as well. He's an excellent time trialist. And I suppose, bearing all of that in mind, for me, he was always the favourite in that quartet, in spite of the fact that Valgren is fast. But it was interesting to hear Michael Valgren say there that Thomas was actually key. Well, Matty Breschel actually said it, that as soon as Thomas was in that group, they knew that he had a good chance.
Yeah, I have to admit, I didn't know that Benjamin Thomas had all those qualities. One of the reasons is probably also I haven't really seen Cofidis much.
Well, you mean he cooks a mean risotto? You didn't know he cooked a mean risotto?
I didn't know that either.
You didn't.
I mean, you know how it is with you when you follow certain riders. I mean, I've known Valgren since he became pro, but I'm pretty sure I knew him even before. And I over-focused when I was watching the stage, and part of me, they always say no cheering in the press box. It was hard for me not, because I also felt a little bit emotionally invested. And it's funny, I sat next to our good friends of the podcast, the Bidon guys, and they were definitely cheering for Valgren because knowing his story and knowing how Matty talks about that as well, knowing how, I mean, he not only was close to losing his career as a bike rider, that could have been a lot worse, that crash, and that was a very, very dire situation.
Yeah, I mean, we heard him and we heard Matty Breschel refer in those interviews to the crash that almost cost him his career. Worth reminding people of that crash and the injuries that it caused. It was in the Route Occitanie a couple of years ago. He broke his pelvis, dislocated his hip, and his knee was in pretty bad shape as well. But I think the hip was the major problem, and it did look at one stage as though he wasn't going to make it back as a professional cyclist. And one of the things I said to Matty Breschel was that it looked at one point as well, without being unkind, that EF Education Easy Post had sort of just done him a solid by giving him another contract in their development team initially, but things looked pretty bleak for him at that point. And slowly he's edged back towards his old self, really. He had that good result in Dwarsdorf-Londres earlier this year.
I saw him in Romandy also, Daniel, and he did quite a late attack there that could have been a stage win. And then I spoke to him the other day in Novara, and I could tell he was super relaxed, and he was like, well, I know there are certain stages that are good for me. I'm going to give it a go. And riders don't really say that if they aren't able to at least be in it to win it.
There was a funny moment, Brian, at the finish. You'll know how it is. Well, you'll have seen this sort of situation, this scenario, many, many times in your previous life as a press officer. And when a rider has finished second and it's an important day and it's an agonizing defeat, and a lot of the journalists there knew that Valgren had a bit of an association with Luca, he lived here as a near professional, and everyone is kind of nervous around the rider, and they don't know how he's going to react, they don't know whether he's going to be upset or angry. And there were half a dozen of us around Valgren, and he took a big mouthful of Haribos, as riders often do at the finish line these days. I don't particularly like Haribo. I don't eat sweets at all, so I never really understood it. But he took a huge mouthful of gummy bears, and it was taking him so long to chew them that, out of politeness, really, he just turned his head and spat them all out and said, "Fuck it, that was taking too long."
I like that.
Yeah, and then. Well, thereafter, he became quite emotional when he started to talk about his journey back to full fitness and everything that he'd experienced out there today on roads that he obviously knew very well. And that, as he told me, was a big motivating factor.
Yeah, and also for Matthew Breschel in the car, and he lived most of his professional career here. And literally on that, I mean, his everyday training ride would go up and down that valley, either towards the coast or further inland. So it was really there, especially for Matty, definitely his home terrain. Mm.
Brian, interesting, in that quartet that went away, well, there were links to Italy everywhere we looked. There were four riders, and all of them had some kind of link to Italy. Can you hear?
Well, there's one of them that
I'm... Well, it's pretty obvious with two of them.
Yeah.
I mean, Valgren lived in Italy as a neopro.
Thomas
lives in Italy now. Paleni, we have to pronounce it the French way. That's obvious. He's obviously got an Italian name. I don't know much about his Italian heritage. I don't know anything about his Italian heritage. He's from Provence. There are a lot of people in Provence that have Italian names, but he must have Italian parents or grandparents. And the other one was Pietro Bon, who's from the United States of the Veneto, as you and I like to refer to it.
It's often when you see an Italian with a last name that finishes in a consonant, it's more or less a given that they're from Veneto.
Yeah, it's very, very often up in the north east. But it was really interesting, and we heard, well, Alessandro Marchi talk about it. We heard Valgren as well, and Breschel indeed talk about why that break was able to succeed today. And, you know, the fact that the race had come back together in the middle of the stage and they only really had to ride hard for 2 hours. De Marchi simply said we shouldn't have let them get any kind of gap, really, or we shouldn't have let them get over a minute because it was always going to be difficult. And so it proved, particularly with that tailwind and Montemagno. Not a difficult climb, particularly, and then there was the descent off there. It was really, everything was sort of set up. I talked to another direct sportif, Matt Winston, at the finish as well, and he said that Alpecin really scored a bit of an own goal in the sense that they pulled very hard early on, seemingly to distance sprinters like Jakobsen,
exactly,
Caleb Ewan, although Caleb Ewan wasn't distanced, and indeed Matt Winston, well, he suggested that Ewan is actually climbing really well and he's on good form. But then having done that, or thought they'd done that, they sort of took their foot off the gas, and there were 20 easy kilometres where everyone was able to recuperate. And it was after that that the four riders went away.
It was fresh legs in that breakaway.
They were very fresh.
Yeah.
Brian, we should also just reiterate what I said at the start of this podcast. What a cracking first 5 days we've had. You know, there were pundits, there were podcasters that suggested, I think the word used by one podcaster was that this Giro route was a turkey of a Giro route. How wrong that particular podcaster was.
What an absolute disgrace. I mean, how could... Yeah. Anyone claim to know anything
about
cycling?
Why has it been so good? Why has it been so good? I think I know why it's been so good, and I know what I got wrong about this first week. I hadn't got my sort of magnifying glass out, and I hadn't seen the little climb today, or Montemagno. I hadn't really considered that. I hadn't really considered Capomele yesterday, and the little rise indeed on the way into Fossano. And it has been those three climbs that have given us three great stages, in addition to the first two that we always knew were going to be exciting.
Yeah, I mean, the devil's in the detail, especially when we often see, or more often than before, that very small gaps sometimes means that riders can actually make it to the finish in modern cycling. And I mean, part of it is also luck. We've been lucky that the riders still make the race, in my opinion, and there's been a huge motivation to, you know, light
up Pogacar's presence on its own but also
it hasn't had a muted effect on the other riders. They aren't just looking to him to, you know, see where the action is. And, you know, because we all, and for all the right reasons, look at Pogacar as someone who's a race-defining character potentially every day, it certainly doesn't mean that the Giro is any less relevant for all the other riders. There's a bunch of stuff to race for, stage wins, you know, and all that. So I think, yeah, we just, for now, it's even with my, you know, I was born with optimism when it comes to the Giro. Maybe it's because I like it being here so much. But it certainly also superseded my expectations.
One slight sour note today was the number of crashes we saw. And particularly, well, some important riders came down. Michael Woods. Michael Woods has kept a very low profile the first few days. I guess he's building towards a break, or he was hoping at least that maybe tomorrow, for example, to Rapolano or Terme could be his first opportunity. There have been, well, we've lost riders. We lost Biniam Gamai as well. And there have been a few riders who have been in the wars multiple times. Attila Valter, the Hungarian champion, is one of them. Now, I had him earmarked as the subject of our chiacchierata del giorno today for a couple of reasons, Brian. One, it was the second anniversary today of the end of the Grande Partenza in Hungary, where he was the big star. It's the 8th of May today, isn't it? In the 8th of May 2022, the Giro concluded its three stages in Hungary. And, well, I was keen to speak to Attila, who we've had on the podcast many times before. And he's an eloquent chap. And I thought it'd be interesting to hear about the legacy of that Grande Partenza in Hungary. And we're not going to hear that bit of the interview, but he did say that it's had a positive effect and cycling does seem to be growing. But we also talked about his crashes in the early part of the Giro. That was before today's crash. As I said earlier on in the podcast, he passed me on his way to the bus and he shouted out to me, "Are the knees fine?" Because he's had lots of knee issues independently, actually, of those crashes that he suffered already in the Giro. He said the knee was good today. The other reason I wanted to speak to Attila today was the Verdi link, because Verdi composed an opera called Attila, which was about Attila the Hun. So
there's always a connection.
There's my very, very tenuous link. So Attila, we're not going to give him official chiacchierata del giorno status. We're just going to hear a little bit of that interview on two subjects. I noticed he gave an interview earlier this week about Visma Lisa Bike's leader at this Giro d'Italia. He's in the white jersey, Kian Uttabrooks, and he's come in for some criticism due to the way he left Bora at the end of last year. And there have been a few sort of raised eyebrows about the fact that he hasn't yet sort of gone to the next level since joining Visma. In the short time that he's been at Visma Lisa Bike, some people thought that this would propel him into another dimension. It hasn't yet, but it may yet do in this Giro d'Italia. And Attila has kind of been talking about this and defending him and saying, look, you know, you've got to be patient with this guy. So we're going to hear a bit of Attila Valter on Kian Uttabrooks. And also, I thought, an interesting observation about Tadej Pogacar, who he came up against, Attila did, a few times when they were under 23s, and has done since, now that they are both professionals. So here's Attila Valter, who is not the subject of today's chiacchierata del giorno.
Yeah, we saw that how good Kian was already in Bora, and yeah, probably he wanted a bit more in the start of the season, but yeah, it's a process. You change coach, you change environment, you change team. Maybe you over-eager a bit, you want too much, and then it can backlash on you. But even not even considering how he will finish this Giro, because I think he can finish really well, but even without, he already showed, I think, in these first 4 days that he is a GC guy. He can be up there. He can climb with the best. He will climb with the best. He's still so young, and he's in the right place now, I think. And for him, I think it's more important now that, yeah, just to change the team, your functional threshold will not go up. So, of course, in a better environment, that's what can make it changed. So probably I also will have the same legs in other teams, but this is the team where I want to be, where I feel like I belong. So that's the important part. And with him, you see now the stress is going a bit lower, that he can perform. Of course, that's with every one of us. And then, you see that he's enjoying in this team. And that's I think, also important. I also don't want to spend my career personally in a team where I perform super well, but you don't feel good. Then what's the point of it? So in this team, you perform good and you can enjoy the life, because we are there for each other. So it's perfect for him. Yeah, it's just the same for me.
Trying to find out more about, more that people don't already know about Tadej Pogacar. You rode against him I think, as under 23s. You came across him a bit. Can you think of anything that maybe you know that other people don't know about Pogacar?
Yeah, not really. I raced a few times against him, not that much. Yeah, nothing any particular. I just like how he's still the same than at that time. So that's I think really important to not change, to enjoy life, enjoy cycling. And of course, when you have those legs, it's quite easy to enjoy, I guess. But yeah, even when he has a bad day, you see him smiling. He takes on life with as a kid, as enjoying. And I think that's something I envy even more than the legs, that he's enjoying whatever life gives. So yeah, he didn't change, and I think it's also one of his superpower.
Great, thanks a lot, Attila. Thank you.
Brian, that was one conversation I had this morning in Genova. It was difficult to reach Genova this morning, wasn't it? A lot of traffic, a lot of problems on the roads, teams delayed. I think even the start was delayed.
Because yeah, I think so as well.
There were a couple of teams who weren't going to make it. I was sort of fumbling around, sprinted to get to the mix zone behind the sign-on podium. Did make it in time to speak to a few riders. We're in Lucca, Brian. I noticed a lot of American accents in Lucca, a lot of American tourists. And I wondered whether Lucca had been invaded by Larry Warbass ultras. We know the impact of the cycling podcast, and we know that Larry's fan base is growing by the stage, by the minute, indeed. I did have an appointment with Larry this morning in Genova, and I did make it for that appointment, in spite of the fact that maybe the reason I didn't make it in time was that we passed their bus on the motorway. They were even later than we were. And we did finally get together in Genova this morning. So here is today's installment of L'Arranzando, a postcard from Italy with Larry Warbass.
L'Arranzando, a postcard from Italy with Larry Warbass.
Larry, it's been a hectic morning. It's been a hectic morning. I think it's been a hectic morning for you. We passed you on the autostrada. We had all sorts of polemica at the bed and breakfast this morning. I bought a travel line the other day, Larry, and I did the responsible thing. I was trying it out on the bed sheets because I've ruined clothes before with the travel line, and I've singed a hole in the bed sheets. Then this morning they asked me €50 to replace the bed sheets. There was
€50 for bed sheets.
And I think it was IKEA as well. There was big polemica. But how are you?
Oh, yeah, I'm decent. You know, I mean, yeah, we have a French bus driver, not an Italian one. So we arrived at the start a little bit late, later than most others, who just zipped up the left side while our bus driver was trying to be correct and stayed in the right lane. But, yeah, so we just got here a few minutes ago. But, I mean, luckily we did our meeting in the bus. We all got ready. So we got to the start ready to go. And, yeah, it should be fine. I mean, luckily it's a sprint day, and I'm not super stressed.
We're heading into Tuscany, a region that you know well, had your brief stint there, living with Taylor Finney. Larry, yesterday Ben had a crash. I think he graze his hip?
Yeah.
Noah, just give us an update.
Yeah, he grazed his hip a bit. So it was with Gourmet and those guys. It's probably like 10 guys that went down. So yeah, it was unfortunately just the guy in front or on the inside just crashed, and then it was just dominoes. And so that wasn't ideal, but he's okay. He got a bit of practice. He crashed in Alps. He crashed at our altitude camp. So, he's just been trying to get a bit more durable over these last bit. And yeah, luckily he's fine. So we had a bit of a chase because, the peloton also split in a few pieces at that point, and we were like a minute and a half behind. So we had to push pretty hard, but we got back, and it's okay.
I know you like to, well, like most riders, you do a bit of a deep dive into training peaks, the stress score, et cetera, of every stage. This Giro so far, how's it looking numbers-wise?
Yeah, actually, I was like kind of disappointed to have three sprint stages in a row. I was like, oh, no, it's going to be kind of easy, and then all these guys are going to recover and stuff, because I like harder a race, but it's actually been hard enough. It's been, even for the quote-unquote sprint stages,
even for a baller like you,
they've been, like, decent. So, they haven't been super, super easy. So, yeah, like, the other day, yeah, the first, like, 80K was super easy. My average heart rate was 76.
No.
For an hour.
Your heart rate
might
be broken, Larry.
No, it's not broken.
But, 76 for how long?
76 for an hour 45. But then, all that stuff happened with the sprinters having their 20-man breakaway, and then my Harvard was no longer 76. But yeah, so that day was super easy the first half, but then super intense for the second. So in the end, it's worked out to be a hard enough race.
Most people's isn't 76 when they're asleep, Larry. Yeah, I'm slightly concerned about you. How's everything else? Hotels good so far?
Actually, yeah. I mean, you know, the hotels themselves are average, but the service has been great, and everyone's been happy to have us, so that's enjoyable. And we've been actually, I think, by ourselves in every hotel without other teams, and that's really nice because it's just a lot more peaceful and calm. So yeah, it's been actually good.
Well, I said you were looking nervous today. I feel like you're looking fresh today, Larry, so I'm encouraged. Going into, some lumpier terrain, your kind of terrain, over the next few days, so I'm very hopeful.
Thanks, yeah. No, it should be good. I'm looking forward to it.
So, Brian, I said a little challenge to our listeners and people who follow us on social media earlier. Guess Larry Warbass's heart rate in the first hour and 20 minutes or so of yesterday's stage. 76, Brian. I mean, what's your... We're sitting here with a lovely glass of white wine. What's currently your heart rate, Brian? Mine's 64. Oh, you don't know. You haven't...
No, I mean, I'm just sort of like...
You
haven't feeling
to
with
take
my
your own
thumb
pulse.
Now.
64. I'm in reasonable shape at the moment.
Yeah, I know.
76. And we know that Larry has a very low heart rate.
Clearly. I mean, I'm glad I'm not officially part of that competition, because the first guess I did was so far.
Yeah, there were some
off.
High ones. Some people were pretty close. I'm not going to award any kind of prize for guessing, but I think, you know, it was fun to try and guess for people. Brian, but I did think about that when analysing what had happened today and thinking about the freshness factor. You know, every sort of hour that is easy in the first 4 or 5 days, then it can have an impact on what we then see in the stages and how fresh the breakaway riders are and how fresh they'll be in a couple of days.
I think it's one of the reasons why quite a few people talk about a big breakaway tomorrow. You know, it's accumulated fatigue. There's riders who know they're not going to be able to do anything, you know, significant in the mountains. And tomorrow is sort of a little bit of everything. Mm. And there's a lot of teams that still need to chase some specific success here. So, yeah, accumulated fatigue, but for some and not for others.
But I'm happy to report, as you heard in that little clip or today's installment of La Ransan, Larry's looking good. He's looking fresh. He's looking, you know, I used the famous Friday Night Lights catchphrase with him the other day. Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose. He looks clear-eyed and fresh, so expecting big things.
He's a handsome devil too, isn't he?
The Peloton's own Jake Gyllenhaal doppelganger. We're expecting big things from Larry in the next few days. I was hungry as well this morning, Brian. So hungry, in fact, that before the stage, I went off in search of some of the local speciality focaccia. But before that, I thought it would be appropriate to speak to a Genovese local and introduce someone indeed to the podcast. She is someone who we might hear from again later in the Giro. She's from Genova and she is Marta Bacigalupo. And she is working as a journalist on this race. Here's Marta, and here's the little odyssey to find some Genovese focaccia that followed our conversation. The sun is shining in Genova. Stage 5 of the Giro d'Italia is about to begin. And, well, it was a rite of passage this morning to find someone who is from Genova. And it's also, happily, coincidentally, someone who I've been wanting to introduce to the listeners for a few days, Marta Bacigalupo. Marta, you are working for my friends at Al Vento podcast, and you're the new signing this year, and I've been listening to your work over the last few days, and what a great signing you've been. But let's start with a superficial question, an insignificant question except for me. We're in Genova, it's famous for focaccia. I was going to seek out the best focaccia in Genova, and there's a place not far away called, I think it's called Mario, Panificio Mario.
Yeah, it's true, actually.
Is it good? Is it good?
I mean, you have all the insights. Mario is actually really good, and there is another one in the Vicoli of Genova, in the really in the historical center, that is called Le Gioie di Luca, I guess. I'm gonna check, but it is amazing. The best focaccia is where you don't expect to find it.
Like
bad places and not really fancy, but the focaccia is the best.
one very important question. A few years ago, I think 3 years ago, we stayed, where was it? It was somewhere up the coast. It was in Liguria, and we were told about this custom of dipping focaccia into cappuccino. And the locals told us that this is something that's very common. Is it?
Yeah, sure. And I was about to tell you, because I know all your cappuccino thing. And actually, I was arguing with Michele yesterday because he told Follia.
Michele Pilacci, he's a big star in Italy, but the English listeners don't know him. English-speaking listeners don't know him yet, but they will be introduced, unfortunately for them, in the next few days.
Yeah, and it's the usual breakfast in Genova. I mean, not for everyone, but in coffee as well, or in cappuccino, you can dip it, but also like eating and drinking together. But the pairing is amazing.
Marta, this is a prelude to longer conversation that we will have later in the Giro. We'll probably have many conversations. This is your first Giro d'Italia.
Yes.
Excuse me for having done some research on you. I do that about. Don't worry, I do that about everyone. Every new entry into the press room, I do some intelligence work to see who they are, where they come from. You've worked for Rolling Stone magazine. Your name shows up at lots of literature festivals. Give us a biography in 1 minute, and tell us how you came to be covering the Giro d'Italia with this bunch of. Cretini.
Exactly. Actually, I'm a creative director in a communication agency, and all the stuff that you mentioned is my like hobbies and things that I really love to do, and I would love to be my real job, but in Italy, as you know, sometimes it's difficult. So I'm doing the creative director full-time, and in my spare time I'm working with the Festival Letteratura di Mantova, that is the best and literature festival in Italy. I was covering festivals in Northern Europe and Scandinavia for Rolling Stone, because Scandinavia and music are my passions, together with cycling. And I was about to, I mean, my biggest wish was to cover Giro d'Italia, and here I am.
The very last thing, Marta, you are taking care of something in the Alvento podcast called the Pogacciario. You're trying to uncover little known or unknown facts about Tadej Pogacar. I've been listening. What do you think the best that you have come up with so far? What's your favorite fact that you've uncovered so far?
So far, I guess so far.
What about the cat caused a lot of? It caused a lot of consternation.
the cat thing is perfect, also because I'm a cat lady, a lot, and that was cool also because I have some friends that have the same thing with cats. I mean, the neighbor cat that is visiting you, and I think that was a really sweet and nice thing to tell about. But I can't reveal my sources, no. You know.
So, Marta disappointed everyone. She shattered lots of people's worlds the other day by revealing that the cat that appeared with Tadej Pogacar in an Instagram post a couple of weeks ago, very cute, I think it was a Siberian cat, was not, in fact, his cat. It was his neighbor's cat. So
Doma was not the name of the cat, but was just home.
So Marta Bacigalupo shattering dreams at the Giro d'Italia.
Settimana di focaccia normale da lavoro.
Grazie.
Un pezzo di focaccia normale.
Ho capito. Sì, 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 la giustizia.
Patate, per favore.
Marta. Marta.
Bravissimo.
Allora, dobbiamo fare la degustazione. We'll do the taste test, Marta. Or just tell me. Have a look in there.
Okay.
How typical. And give it a.
Let me see.
So what are we looking for here?
The What's color is okay. The I think it's thick enough, but not too much.
I went for the potato one. Is that a bit like getting pineapple on pizza?
Ah, okay, the potato. Yeah, this is kind of a fusion fusion thing. It's not traditional, but you got also the real one. So it's fine.
So you're impressed. So I'm a real Genovese now.
Enjoy.
Thanks very much. Brian, we got the verdict from Marta. I don't see you as a kind of focaccia man. You've already proclaimed your something else with Liguria this morning. Do you want a bit of focaccia?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we buy focaccia every day at home because the kids love it. No, it's good. It's quite sort of It's quite moist.
Well, don't thank me, Brian. Thank Mario.
Grazie, Mario.
So, Brian, that was lunchtime today. So we've covered the focaccia. We've covered, well, I alluded with Larry to the iron incident. We were not going to dwell on that anymore.
But I actually took out the time to go and pick up what I think is potentially one of the best sandwiches I've ever had. In Genoa, for you, my friend.
It was excellent. And it was strictly vegetarian, which I was grateful for. Which will bring us in just a second, Brian, to last night's dinner.
La tappa di domani e la cena di ieri. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Last night's dinner, Brian. Do you want to just gloss over it completely, or
How there's been a certain quote from Matthias Gelmose that's sort of been floating around social media. You know, if you fly too close to the sun. This was said in relation to him trying to follow Tadej Pogacar on La Redoute. And he said after the Liège-Bastogne-Liège that if you fly too close to the sun, you get your wings burned. The Icarus reference. And that's, I think we've been flying too close to the sun lately, because the karma was a pizza yesterday. And it wasn't great, but it was serviceable. It was compared to what we've been used to, and you know, one can only hope. And I'm not saying it was a bad meal. There aren't many of those in Italy. They're hard to come by. But it was, you and I talked about Liguria. It's sort of like, I can never really tell whether I particularly like it or not. And I think that part, maybe combined with the ironing incident of this morning, it definitely felt like that.
Left a bit of a sour taste. We were glad to see Tuscany this afternoon. Oh. Midway through this afternoon, when we passed the border of Liguria and Tuscany, we were happy. And Brian was particularly happy because he could see home on the horizon. And indeed, he will be home this evening, because he's going to spend the evening in his current residence in Pietrasanta. I'm also going to be staying in Pietrasanta, but not in Brian's spare room this evening. Brian, tomorrow's stage will still be in Tuscany, entirely in Tuscany, if I'm not mistaken. Yesterday, you got the evening off in the sense, though, or you got this segment of the podcast you were relieved from, because we had another Tuscan on the podcast, and that was Max Chandri, the Movistar director sportive, who is from Quarata.
He was born in Lido di Camaiore.
Ah, yes, he was. So very close to here. And Quarata is just a little bit to the east of here. But he certainly knows these roads very well. He knows this terrain very well. By the sounds of what we're about to hear, he's also done a recon of tomorrow's stage. Tomorrow's very keenly anticipated stage, because there are some gravel roads, some strade bianche. So let's hear from Max, shall we, about what we should expect from tomorrow's stage 6.
So stage 6 is Torre del Lago, right close to Viareggio, and it finishes in Rapolano Terme, a small little town, thermal town, in the Siena area. So it's a stage I know. We go through Volterra, and it's a gradual, again, long climb into Volterra.
Beautiful town.
Beautiful town. We're talking about fantastic area, cycling area, food area, weather, anything is there. And then we go into the dirt sections. We have, they're basically three dirt sections, and the first dirt section is exactly the same start. You enter the same way as you enter in Strade Bianche, exactly the same way. Halfway into the dirt section, you go right for another K and a half. You exit on the left, then you have 2K into the next section, what's basically uphill with a couple sharp descents, but it's basically all the way uphill, the second dirt section. Then you have another 20-odd K, something like that, to the third section, where it's flat. You go through Asciano. Again, Asciano's a town just before you hit Santi Maria in Strade Bianche, so the hot point of Strade Bianche. You go through Asciano, you go through the old town of Asciano, through a big arch into the old town, out of the arch. And then you go towards Rapolano Terme, where you actually exit the main road as you go into Rapolano Terme. You exit this main road and you go into this small little town with a 1K kick up of around 10%. You stay in smaller roads till you exit 2.5k to the finish, you enter again the big road, the main road, and you go into the finish in Rapolano Terme, where it's got a slight kick up.
Sounds like a recipe for ricetta da Pogacar.
Yeah, and I'd say it's something I was talking actually to other people before, and I think it should be a breakaway day. That's what I would go for, a breakaway day. I mean, if I had the jersey, I'd let a breakaway go. And everybody needs a piece of cake in this Giro.
Max has whetted the appetite there, talked about the likelihood of a break going away, and staying away indeed. I mentioned my conversation with Matt Winston earlier in the podcast. He doesn't think a break is going to stay away. He thinks that everyone is going to be so nervous in the early part of the stage, particularly the GC riders, that will doom any kind of break. They'll be so keen to stay close to the front of the race that the pace will be very high, even in the first couple of hours, and that will make it very hard for a break to stay away.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously going to be one or the other. I'm probably more inclined to think that it's going to be a breakaway.
Should we indulge in something we rarely do in the Giro podcast? Should we make any predictions? I quite fancy Schachmann. Yeah. I had an appointment to speak to him this morning, but between his bus's delay and our delay, it didn't happen. I think he's riding well. He's ridden well in Strade Bianche before. I think he might be a decent bet. You heard earlier from Alessandro De Marchi. He's a rider who one might think would be suited to today's stage.
I mean, if Valgren hadn't done what he did today...
I'm sorry, tomorrow's stage.
He would have been an obvious rider. And actually, when you look at EF Education first, whatever the last bit is, they're really here to chase stages. I think, you know, Esteban Chavez is dwindling a little bit in the GC. But I have a feeling that they'll target every stage like a one-day race. So they will definitely be one of the teams trying tomorrow, I think.
I think that's enough speculation, isn't it, Brian? I think we'll conclude this evening's podcast there. The streets in Lucca are starting to fill up. I can see a lot of people with wine glasses, a lot of people enjoying their aperitivo. As I said earlier, we'll be heading towards Pietrasanta very soon. A couple of last bits of housekeeping. Keep your eye on our Substack, the 1101 Cappuccino, which has got filled with lots of goodies at the moment, including some of the interviews you don't hear here. That's awkward to say. In the podcast, a lot of sort of bin ends, but some really good stuff, I hope, as well. And also, don't forget our Girovaganda wine selection. We've talked a bit about wine tonight. And, of course, with Divine Cellars, we've selected 6 bottles that sort of represent the terroir of this year's Giro d'Italia. Head to Divine, that's all one word, cellars.com. Final thing I should mention is that our Giro coverage, as ever, features wonderful music of Amara Terra, the band, the Pizzica band from down there. Well, their origins are in Puglia, in the Salento. Brian, that concludes Stage 5's Girovagando podcast.
Buonasera.
Buonasera.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.